good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday, the 15th of August. I hope you are all well. I hope you are all healthy. I hope you're doing as good as can be expected on this day. We have beautiful weather and a little chill in the air, and it's it feels good, and we'll take it. So good morning all, and thank you very much for being with us. We have a great group this morning, four wonderful people who are just terrific panelists, and joined together to discuss the issues of the day, and I'll introduce them in just a moment. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and then we'll get into the stuff, you know, the stories of the day, the things that we have to talk about. One of them I can really talk at great length about because, you know, we all have those our cars do things that we don't know what it does, right? There's like it has all these bells and whistles, and we don't really know. They give you a 5-minute tutorial, and maybe you read the book, maybe you don't, and you don't know what your car does. Well, yesterday I was in my car, and all of a sudden it went ding, and I looked up, and on the dashboard it said your ignition has been on for 4 hours without movement. Now, the first question you're going to ask is, Joe, was your car on for 4 hours without movement? And the answer is, yes, it was. But I didn't know that it did that. And I also was unaware that it had been 4 hours that I was in the car. But what happened was I was driving home, and I got pretty close to the house, maybe about 6 miles away from the house. And my cell phone rings, and it's a dear friend of mine who I'm going to go visit this weekend. So I do what?
Pull over like a responsible driver?
On the side of the road. That's right, Malia. That is what I do. I pull over to the side of the road to take the call. And
was this in a cornfield you were?
No. This is on County Route 60. In Washington County, so yes, a cornfield. So I'm there, and we're talking, and not for very long. I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes, and all of a sudden the car just starts to list to the right, and it gets to be a little bit more and a little bit more, and I thought, well, this is odd. So I put the car in drive, and I start to move forward. Well, that's not good, because this is now bringing me further and further into a ditch. So then I do what you do, which is go backwards, go forwards, go backwards, go forwards, and I can't now get out of the ditch. Now, I was about two inches off the pavement, and now I'm about 2 feet off the pavement, because the car is not moving other than sideways into the ditch. Now, on the right-hand side, I look, and all I can see is the woods and the ditch. And when I look out my right-hand side window, my driver's side window, all I see is sky.
Is your friend still on the line?
No. Oh. We ended the conversation so I could attend to my issue. So, there's a moment there where you think you can get out, and I don't know. There used to be a time in Washington County where everybody had a pickup truck. And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I'm very much pro electric vehicles, but I'll tell you one thing: the 45 Priuses that passed me just can't pull me out of a ditch. They can't do it. So I ended up calling AAA, and AAA. I love AAA. So AAA come. So they say they're going to send somebody, and because they send them from, and Judy will know this doing the geography. They'll send them from Fort Edward Hudson Falls, and that's like a 30-mile drive. So it takes a while. But anyway, so I'm in the car, and So my control panel is all kind of messed up because it usually is messed up, but it's having trouble getting a signal. I can't. There's a radio station. I was listening to CNN. The radio station is on, but the control panel is completely off. So I have no control over it whatsoever. So I can't turn the station. I can't adjust the volume. I can't do anything.
Oh, no.
And that's when they started playing Trump's speech. And for an hour and a half, while I'm waiting for AAA, I'm listening to this.
In a ditch. There you go.
I mean, it's perfect. And I look, I'm not saying what I went through is anything as horrific as waterboarding. However. So... one guy stopped and rolled down his window. And I will say, out of all the cars that passed, all but three stopped to say, "Are you all right?" Which is very nice if you think about
it. That is so sweet.
One guy rolled down the window and he goes, "Hey, are you Joe Donahue?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "The guy on the radio?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "Are you all right?" I said, "I'm fine." He said, "Is there anything I can do?" I said, "Yes. Don't tell anyone about this." Please, whatever you do, just don't tell anyone how stupid I am. Guy comes from AAA, parks the truck, puts the hook on the front, presses a button, whoop, I'm out of there. Done. And the last words that I heard as I was being pulled out of the ditch were, "And in conclusion." So now I have to go get my car fixed because it's shimmying. Because there's all just like all this like, you know, 9 buckets of muck underneath the bottom of the car. Yeah, it's
I don't know who thought of AAA, but it is a really good thing.
Oh my goodness!
Isn't it a good thing?
Oh my goodness!
And the maps. I love.
I'm
the maps.
So well. The maps are great, and they're great, and they're always very nice. And the thing I liked about it is they say, you know, we'll be there at this time. And they're there at that time.
Well, you can follow the truck's progress.
That's
like
right.
Like an Uber.
That's right. I mean, if you had cell service, yes, you could do that.
or if you knew how to use your phone properly.
No, I called. I mean, I was able sort of in and out of that. But yeah, it was good. But I'm glad to be out of the car. I'm glad to be with all of you. Thank you very much.
That story beats mine. I was here in Albany on Tuesday for a board meeting, and I drove home to Woodstock. And literally, as I pulled my car into my garage, I got a message on the thing saying low tire pressure. And I look in the back, and the tire in the left behind the driver's side is flat. And I'm thinking, I made it all the way up and back to Albany without blowing out. It's a miracle.
It is a miracle.
So, but I like your story better because it involved Trump and everything involves Trump.
It's always about Trump. So when we get to that story, I have a lot to say, just so you know. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is here. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMont is with us.
Good morning.
Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld in the house.
Good morning.
And Vice President and Editorial Development of the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you all here. Thank you. All right, let's get started. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear what you have on your mind on this Thursday morning. So the big news before we talk about Trump is that this broke yesterday around 8:39 o'clock last night, where Nemat Shafik, the president of Columbia University, has resigned. And this is after a long battle back and forth. Resigned Wednesday after months of far-reaching fury over her handling of pro-Palestinian demonstrations and questions over her management of a bitterly divided campus. She was the third leader of an Ivy League university to resign in about 8 months following maligned appearances before Congress about anti-Semitism on their campuses. Elise Stefanik tweeting last night, "One down, everyone else to go." Dr. Shafik, is an economist who spent much of her career in London, and in a letter, and I believe goes by Mnuch.
That's my understanding.
Yes, Mnuch. So if you think I just didn't know that. But anyway, an economist who spent much of her career in London said in a letter to the Columbia community that while she felt the campus had made progress in some important areas, it had also been a period of turmoil where it has been difficult to overcome divergent views across our community. All right, so let us begin with the chief of staff of a college and as to your thoughts on this story, Malia.
Yeah, well, I mean, the headline says it's unexpected, and it's hard to know if it's unexpected within the Columbia community. There's a lot we don't know about how this came about. But what we do know is, like last spring, before the congressional testimony, she and Columbia were lifted up as examples, and before things really got out of hand, of good management of what seemed to be not yet a crisis, but certainly a difficult time of relations between the university and its students. And that that devolved as the situation in Columbia really got out of control. A lot of outsiders came in, and there was the students took over buildings, and students from other universities started going there to get training on how to expand this kind of movement. She survived that. She survived the congressional testimony, which didn't look good for anyone who participated in it. There are a couple reasons we could think about. Why is she resigning now? It's possible that there's been discontent within the Board of Trustees of Columbia about her leadership, and they have been wanting to move on. That's one possibility, and she decided to resign because of that. Another possibility, I think, is actually there's a high likelihood of this, is that she's someone who wanted to be a leader at the university, and then was sucked into this situation and looked at the semester coming up and thought, I don't want to continue to deal with this. I mean, students are going to be coming back soon, and a lot of university leaders, I think, their crisis management is not their background.
Right.
That it's not something that that anyone really looks forward to in most cases, and it doesn't look like a fulfilling or job opportunity anymore, and not really doing the work maybe that she expected to be doing. So it's possible that that's what motivated this sort of unexpected resignation as well.
Not saying that this is what happened at all, but you could see, just as you outlined, where you finish up the semester and you say, okay, let me see the dust settle.
Yeah.
And see how things, where we are, and then go forward, and then suddenly turn the page of the calendar and go, oh, God.
Well, she also had a job lined up. And the story in the paper in the Times, and I don't remember where it is, but she has a job she is going to. Might be in England, but...
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Yes, yeah. To go in to London, yes. Judy.
So look at this from two different levels. From the kids headed off to Columbia this week, packing their bags, going into the dorms. Do they care? No, they probably don't care. But from a higher level, you see the Republicans continuing to attack higher education. I mean, the fact that did Lee Stefanik really tweet that? One down or three down?
I'll get the.
I thought she tweeted that like when the first one
resigned.
Right.
She did last night. Yeah. The attack on higher education is one that's has always mystified me, because in this country we tended to value education, but I still remember having Tea Party people come into my office when I was the editor of a newspaper, and their big complaint to me was that I was too educated. So I think. Remember Donald Trump saying on the stump, maybe it was in the 2016 election, he loves the uneducated. If you're uneducated, you're not discerning. You can't make you can't differentiate between truth and fact.
The actual quote was, three down, so many to go.
Yeah, that's so higher education is something we should value in this country, and it's something that increasingly has come under attack by the far right.
Well, I have, with a couple of caveats, I would say the following. First of all, I'm a big believer in student protests. It's part of the great tradition of academia in this country. It didn't start with this most recent event. I can recall when I was in New Paltz in the late 60s, there were protests, and it was a regular part of the being on the campus. But it gave the students an opportunity to start molding ideas, and some of them took it too far and by taking over buildings and offices, and some of them will learn from, all of them, I think, will learn from the experience. And I don't object. I would not be among those who was critical of a college president who is trying to allow students to exercise their free speech rights and their academic credentials or their academic learning. The caveats are, well, you don't want anybody to get hurt. You don't want the physical plant to be damaged. You want people of all sides to be able to walk on campus and feel that they're not going to get hit on the head with a baseball bat. And
10 seconds.
I think that this college president and all college presidents have got it tougher today, much like we all have it tougher today making decisions.
We'll talk about that toughness. We'll hear from Teresa and much more when we return right after this short. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday. It's the 15th of August, 33 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm Joe Donahue, joined by Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Amelia DeMont, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. This for Ira from Barbara. Yesterday, the same message popped up on my panel, Ira. Low tire pressure. I got out and I checked the pressure all around and they were all perfect. So the silly computer was messing with me. Now I have to go to the dealer to find out how to turn the message off.
Well, I had a flat tire. So I...
Okay. Well, so the computer wasn't messing with you. The computer was helping you.
No. And I'm the worst guy who... You don't want to have me near a wheel when something goes wrong with the car.
We've been talking about the resignation of the Columbia president, Manoush Shafiq, that was announced yesterday after the turmoil on campuses this spring. Is there anything additional that you wanted to mention, Ira, before?
No, I'm worn out.
Okay, yeah, I can understand that. Teresa Bourgeois.
Yeah, well, even though it was a surprise announcement, it appeared basically from her resignation letter that this was long in the making. I mean, the UK, as you noted, Ira, UK Foreign Secretary, and this is from her departure letter, had invited her to chair a review of the government's approach to international development and how to improve capabilities. She had been at the London School of Economics. She's going back to London and to continue her work, as she says, on fighting global poverty and promoting sustainable development areas. I find this attack on universities so disturbing, and as you note, an attack on use of your freedom of speech. You know, she talks about her core values and principles that are dear to her: academic freedom, free speech, openness to ideas, zero tolerance for discrimination of any kind, including gender, race, religion. If you step back and listen to what Trump has said, what's in the platform, what's posted on his site, what he says in his speeches, and what's in Project 2025 about education in general and higher education. They're talking about the dismantling of the education department and particularly removing any reference to DEI,
diversity, equity, inclusion.
Thank you. Diversity, equity, inclusion. And there's clearly the Republicans, as the party is configured now, has a real concern about that, about any sorts of diversity and freedoms, freedom of speech. I think that Elise Stefanik, I don't know if this is where it originated, but she is a graduate of Harvard and was on the Kennedy School Board of a Kennedy School Board of Advisors at Harvard, and after she did not denounce the, or after denouncing what happened on January 6th, she then agreed with Trump about the election. You know, she's an election denier. And so she was removed from that advisory committee. And maybe it's causal, maybe it's not, but it seems that she got much more vocal after that and this attack on presidents. And it seems a bit, I don't know, unseemly is the word that comes to my mind. But if on the, you know, the Trump gave this economic speech and you're talking about how to revive the economy, well, you can't do that without universities, right? And you need the science, you need the research, you need training people. And, you know, what's the long-term, what is the long-term goal here in going after universities and trying to discredit universities? Short-term goal, maybe they think with the Jewish community in this, you know, case, they get some public, political support. But what's the long-term goal in attacking universities?
John writes to us and says, conservatives think education equals indoctrination. Because to conservatives, indoctrination is education. Conservatives don't teach, they indoctrinate and always have. Actually, teaching people have to think, which is the entire purpose of a university, shouty caps, and is what they were founded for, objectively terrifies conservatives and always has. That from John. Rick says, I beg to differ with Teresa's comments that America values education. Though most of us educated people really do, it is pretty common knowledge that in general, throughout history, working class Americans have been suspicious of educated people. They are mocked in cinema and rarely ever looked up to. It's sad, I know, but it seems pretty true. Then we go to Joan, Dr. Shafiq's resignation follows in the heels of the resignation of three deans who were found to engage in anti-Semitic texting. I don't know anything. I didn't read.
Oh, yeah. That was really terrible.
Right. At Columbia.
Yeah, they were in full view. I mean, they were just not very careful. In full view of people. They were sitting in an auditorium attending an event and texting each other things are clearly derogatory. So they were put on administrative leave, and now they've all left.
Anybody? Okay. Then we go to, to Harv, who says, after showing callous disregard for the safety of Jewish students on campus and losing control of the blatant anti-Semitism shown by some members of the Columbia University faculty, and for losing control of the campus to pro-Palestine rioters, the president of the Ivy League college has resigned. This shows once again that vigilance against anti-Semites and those who want to trample on Israel are being watched, and that there will be legal, peaceful, and justified consequences for them. As a master's graduate of Teachers College, Columbia University, I could not be happier. That from Harv. Then we go to this letter. I don't know who said it, but I'm disturbed that I did not hear anyone push back on the comment that the uneducated, quote unquote, are unable to be discerning. That's insulting to many people on many levels. My late father had a high school education and was firmly blue collar, and he was one of the most discerning thinkers I have ever known. He read newspapers and watched the network evening news, and he would have hated Fox News and all its evil spawn. Please avoid those generalizing comments that put the uneducated into the, quote, basket of deplorables. I don't recall anyone.
I don't either, but I've long said on this air and elsewhere that I think the people who believe the far right, the MAGA people, the Trump supporters are stupid, are not the people on the left, but it's the leaders of the MAGA movement and Trump, because all they do is feed their followers lies and misinformation, and they expect them not to be discerning.
I'm the guilty one on the uneducated comment, because what we're primarily focused on is formal education. I mean, that is it's the higher education part of it. I think if you're watching the news and you're reading the newspapers, you're not uneducated. You are educating yourself. But what we're seeing from the far right again is capitalizing on the fact that there are people who do not discern between fact and fiction, and they're easily led and they're easily indoctrinated, as an earlier writer noted. Going into higher education does teach you to be more tolerant, I think. That's something I learned in college, is tolerance and the fact that there are different kinds of people in the world. It's not something you often get just through high school, or if you only went through eighth grade, which there are a lot of people in this country that only completed education through eighth grade. So you're not aware of how government operates in many instances. I'm not generalizing that. About it, there are people who do not get a formal education that can be discerning, but by and large, if you haven't learned about how systems operate, how different people in the world live, you are more apt to be indoctrinated.
I do agree. I mean, I think you can make a distinction between uninformed and uneducated. I think those are two separate things, and I do think you can become an educated, informed outside of a formal, college education structure. And a lot of people I know who don't have college degrees are very wise and learn a lot in their, in their areas of endeavor. I think there are lots of ways to get educated, and maybe that's what the person is talking about. But I do think that there's another layer of this, and one of the writers talked about it, and I think it went for the university president. I don't know this for sure, but some of the things I read about her and some of the statements she talked, some of what she talked about in her statement, there was also, a fair level of threats against her and her family. And I think that you've seen that with universities, we've seen that with judges, we've seen that with election officials. We've seen that across the board now, and I think that this is a piece of this puzzle that we've seen since 2016. It's not that it didn't exist before, but it's really magnified, and there needs to get a handle on this, because people should not, they and their families should not be at risk, should not have to leave their homes. I'm not suggesting, but I think about the funny situation and the prosecutor in Atlanta who's had to leave her home and move every couple of months because her life is at risk, and this has got to stop.
I think the listener who wrote in about the historical aspects of this was pretty astute. So there is an anti-intellectual strain that runs throughout American history. I don't think it's necessarily anti-education.
Right.
It's more of a class-based critique of American society, where educational institutions are often seen as being very elitist, and not so that it may be hard in some cases to draw a distinction between the education you receive at some institutions and the institution itself. But I think a lot of the concern among even some moderate Republicans is about the way the institutions are being managed, and what that means for the kind of education you're receiving there. And it's relatively easy to capitalize on that from a political perspective, because there is such a history of that kind of anti-elitist strain, particularly in more conservative circles.
But isn't that because of the exclusivity? Isn't it that all the more reason why you need diversity, particularly economic diversity in these universities, which they've been trying to move toward? I mean,
and ideological diversity
and
as well.
Ideological diversity, all the range of diversities are needed, and it's finally opening up a bit.
Let's take a break. We'll pause there. When we come back, we'll move on to other topics. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Turning to presidential politics, former President Donald Trump's speech on Wednesday in Asheville, North Carolina, his first event in a battleground state in nearly 2 weeks, was supposed to offer him a bit of a reset after his Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, gained significant momentum. His top advisors have urged him to focus on policy issues, and he vowed to about 2,000 people in an Asheville auditorium that he would do just that, giving a speech that he said would focus squarely on the economy and inflation. But in a speech lasting more than an hour, an hour and 23 minutes, but who's counting? Mr. Trump often veered far from that aim. He jeered President Biden over being pressured to exit the race, frequently criticized the Biden administration's immigration policy, broadly attacked undocumented immigrants as criminals, and lobbed a series of personal attacks at Ms. Harris, whom he claimed had been chosen after Democrats, quote, decided to get politically correct. Her laugh is career threatening, Mr. Trump said of Ms. Harris, adding, that's a laugh of a person with some big problems. Mr. Trump did spend considerable time discussing economic issues, largely reassigning to Ms. Harris attacks he has made for years against Mr. Biden over his ability to curb inflation and price increases. He argued that she had been in a position to address both issues but had not made significant progress. Just remember, she goes to work every morning in the West Wing, Mr. Trump told the crowd. Her desk is 10 steps from the Oval Office. He added, for nearly 4 years, Kamala has cackled at as the American economy has burned. Mr. Trump stood in front of signs referring to his proposals to end taxes on Social Security benefits and on tips for hospitality workers. He said of the economy, they say it's the most important subject, but he added, I think crime is right there. I think the border is right there. We have a lot of important subjects. Thoughts? Ira?
Oh, it just makes my blood boil. You know, I don't know if I said this earlier, but he makes so many statements that are demonstrably false and can be proven by them being false because there's audio tape and there's video to record what he said that he now denies he said. And I think he has no regard for those people he's talking to because he knows they're going to buy into it, whether or not it's true. The fact that he has chosen of all of the attack lines to attack Kamala Harris's laugh is laughable. I mean, it's just this is right out of the schoolyard in Queens or in Forest Hills, wherever he grew up, and this is the kind of joking stuff you do to your fellow friends on the playgrounds. And here is a guy who was the president and is trying to again evolving into that level of discourse. It's just very depressing.
I think, excuse me, I think his focusing on her laugh is a symptom of the fact he can't help himself from personal attacks, but it's also, to me, a signal that the other kinds of ways he's criticizing her aren't really gaining a lot of traction. He hasn't really settled or found a way to really criticize her in a way that's resonating more broadly. And so what I hear him saying, he's a manifestation of what the crowd in front of him wants to hear. He just sort of reflects back to them what they expect. And he hasn't come up with anything new. Now, the word cackle, which sort of, it implies, you think of cackle, I think of a witch, right? And that kind of demonizing is really disgusting. Not surprising from him, but
sexist.
Yes, all kinds of terrible things. But it just shows that he still hasn't found his footing in this newly restructured race.
What a bunch of mush, don't you think? I mean, I would have the advantage of being able to change the channel. I was so disappointed that CNN aired this live. And I thought, I kept on listening, thinking, oh, they're going to break away when they realize this is the standard mush. But they didn't. They stuck with it, as Joe can attest.
Yeah. I mean, they stuck with it for real. They did eventually, but it was essentially over at that point. And I was surprised, too. I thought, I don't know. I mean, we could talk about this. It seems that before they aired it, a reporter said we have a copy of the speech and there's a lot of information in here, but we have no guarantee that he's going to get to any of it. But that to me isn't an excuse because We know that by now, right? I mean, how many times have we heard this? We heard it. I mean, the most famous example within the last few months is the Republican National Convention, where we heard, you know, it was going to be a unifying speech, and it was for a millisecond, and then it just went off the rails. So I don't know. So, yes, I agree with you completely. I was very sorry that they went to it, and I just don't know how many times you're going to be, like, fooled by the fact that because we made a poster that says about taxes that for some reason that he's going to stick just to that topic. Also, it was really weird to me, Teresa, how he kept on referring to it as if, like, he almost was being forced, which I assume he was, but being forced. These aren't the things I want to talk about, but they tell me I have to talk about them. It's really important. These really aren't the important things. There are other important things, but this is something I have to talk about. We're going to talk about the about inflation and economy. And then he would riff, and then he would go back. And it was really odd, because it was as if somebody gave him a stack of papers and said, read this. And then he didn't really want to and just did his own version.
CNN's been taking the Walz-Harris rallies live also, haven't they?
Some of them, yeah.
So, because I was thinking maybe
Both cases, some of them.
That one of the reasons why they may have aired Trump yesterday is they may have felt an obligation because they've been airing the other side.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because of it was supposed to be policy driven, and they wanted to, but you know, is that going to be the case? I don't know. I know they took the Walz speech because it was his first solo event, and he was to be, which he did, address his military record. So I know that was the case.
I mean, who handed him a stack of papers and expected him to? I mean, has that ever happened in the history of his entire career in the public eye?
Not to my knowledge. Teresa.
Well, I actually, my overall impression was what you just pointed out, which it just seemed to me that he read parts of the speech, and in reading it, some of it, he was almost surprised by the content, and then would do sidebar comments on what he was reading.
As if he was reading it for the first time.
As if he was reading it for the first time. Yeah. And he did say over and over, they want him to talk about the economy. They think it's important. And I remember at one point he said that he thought inflation was important and that maybe that's part of the economy, but inflation is important. But I think what they really, as a sidebar, I think what they really want him to do is stop using the word inflation and start using the word cost, because the data on inflation is good for the Biden-Harris administration. And, you know, they were good. There are good numbers out in the last week.
But more, since when do they care about data either?
Right. More good numbers today in terms of, you know, Walmart has a good report, economic report. Retail sales are up, which shows that people are comfortable buying. But broadly, I was thinking, I listened to Nikki Haley interview, was it last night or the night before? I heard it last night. I'm not quite sure when she did it because it was a bit of a blur. But talking about if only he would focus on the issues and not on the insults. But that's not his playbook. His, you know, from his show, The Apprentice, it was an attack thing. You know, nobody got a rose. They got fired, right? It was an attack. His political playbook has always been attacks. They've been racially based. They've been economic based. They've been gender based. He openly, you know, he polls on what denigrating name he should call people. I mean, he's a one-trick pony. It's a bully. It's attack, attack, attack. But then buried in all that attack were some policies. And I know he was very upset where he said that Vice President Harris stole his idea about tax on tips. Well, that wasn't original to him. But in fact, his tax on tips was too broad, in that it could, some people speculate, the way he's proposed it, it could allow, on Wall Street there are bonuses, and that those be relabeled as quote-unquote tips, and so that they won't have to pay taxes on those. And that would be an enormous economic hit for New York State and other places, for instance. And so she understood to narrowly focus. And the other thing about tax on tips is most people in the restaurant or, you know, bar business or service businesses, I think only about 2% of them make enough to have to pay taxes. And so if, in fact, it is reportable income, most of them aren't going to, I mean, only 2%, yeah, make enough to actually have to pay taxes. So it's not going to really impact that many people who he claims it will impact. But more broadly, there was not a lot of substance in there. And what it was, he read it and seemed surprised by some of it. I mean, so is that who, again, is this really the person who should be in the White House again? A person who's a bully, a person who doesn't have any depth in policy, a person who denigrates people based on their gender and their race? I don't think so.
So there's a press conference, I think, that he's having today. And the question is, do the cable stations air this live or do they not? I mean, especially because the first part of his press conferences typically are a rant. And so he's not answering questions.
Or stump speech. Polite about it.
Yeah, but isn't it? I mean, he's not out campaigning. That's the other question. He is not out campaigning. He's basically doing one, maybe two events a week in swing states. He is basically campaigning from Mar-a-Lago, and the campaigning is doing the Elon Musk thing, which, what was that, by the way, on so many levels. Or now he's on this drumbeat that why isn't Vice President Harris taking questions? Well, she is, but not in the formal way as the way we get our information changes. But this is really a counter programming to the vice president. The president are in Maryland today. It's the eve of the anniversary of the signing of the Inflation Reduction Act, and they're talking about, among other things, the final rule on the cost of prescription drugs, where they've lowered these 10 prescription drugs. It's going to save billions of dollars in the Medicare system and will bring down prices. But they're going to talk about how to lower costs. And then Vice President Harris is doing her economic speech tomorrow. And this is a counter programming, but he's not going past Mar-a-Lago.
Trump, do we have a break?
We do have to take a break. Okay, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. And we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Ray Graff with news is next. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Malia DeMont, and Teresa Bourgeois with us this morning, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. A couple letters that we have in regards to the conversation we had going up to the break. Dan says, Trump and his campaign can't focus on policy speeches because he doesn't have any policies unless you count ego feeding or financial enrichment. Anything resembling a Trump policy is fluid because it is subject to change from day to day for anyone who bids higher or bows lower. Then we go to Deborah. I think it was The Daily Show that did a split screen of Trump denigrating Biden and then using the exact same words to attack Harris. That was brilliant. I don't know if anyone hasn't seen it. It was this past Monday. And it's brilliant the way it was done, there's a lot of examples. So he can't remember more than the same limited vocabulary. Why hasn't the media, like the New York Times, which went after Biden's cognitive ability, just discussed this reality of a guy with limited capacity, not to mention weird hand gestures? I mean, in fairness to the New York Times, they have covered the cognitive aspect of the story.
As have most other media, print and broadcast.
Yes, I agreed.
He does seem more and more diminished and more confused, and he constantly goes back to that core issue of his, you know, the get the migrants out, and the migrants are, that his shift last night about Venezuela, he was talking about drill, baby, drill. And then he was talking about us getting Venezuelan oil. In the middle of talking about getting Venezuelan oil, he then shifted to the Venezuela is emptying out his prisons and sending them all to the United States, and then went on his standard riff about how dangerous that is. Well, reporters have repeatedly asked his campaign to show any proof that this is happening in any country. And they reportedly have gotten no verification of that, not only not in Venezuela, in any other country. but it's his go-to rift. And he says it was such deep-seated anger. And then he talks about how he's going to deport people on day one. He went off on a riff on that yesterday as well. And that, but interesting that he talks about migrants in the context of the economy, because business people would probably tell him that they are desperately in need of workers. And unlike his assumption that it's taking people's jobs, I would guess if you poll business workers, the business leaders, you know, they would say they need the labor.
He's gaslighting. He's a con man. He can come up with your own name for it. It's just, it shouldn't surprise us anymore. It's infuriating for those of us who can see through it. And I think it's contrary to what he may think, most people can see through it. At least the polls are starting to show that. And, you know, have you seen the commentary by his 11-day communications chief, Scaramucci, who knows Trump and knows him for a long time? He believes that Trump will eventually drop out. Now, this is pie-in-the-sky stuff, but if rather than take a humiliating defeat, he may say there's health issues or something, but he won't make it to the finish line.
I haven't heard.
Yes. I have heard that.
Scaramucci has a podcast with Caddy Kay, and that's been quite a bit of discussion.
We've discussed it on this show. It's something that's come up a couple of times. I personally don't see it happening. I don't see someone with that ego saying that they're not going to fulfill something. And why would you do it if the easiest way to combat that is just to say they stole the election again?
Well, it'll be harder for him to do that if it's a landslide.
But also, you know, he needs to keep himself out of jail. Let me rephrase that. I don't say out of jail. He needs to have these many court issues go away. And the way they go away is if he gets elected.
Yeah, without a doubt.
And I don't think that he's going to jail, but he needs to have these court cases go away. But I have heard Scaramucci talk about he thinks that he will not keep Vance. And he thinks, because Vance is getting better and better, the lies continue. But his speech yesterday, which we haven't talked about in Michigan, it was, let's call it artfully, if not honestly, crafted new message on the economy that is a pretty tight message. And it's filled with, you know, factual flaws, shall we say. But it is a tight message, and he is getting better speaking. The more attention he gets, I think, you know how Trump always has to be the person out front. In any case, letters.
All right, let's move on. We'll go to, one more letter, this one from Pat, who says, whenever the Republicans run for president or vice president, they proudly tell us they went to Yale or Wharton or wherever, and it is hypocritical. That from Pat. Let's move on to other topics. We go to the relationship between the President of the United States and Nancy Pelosi. These are two very, very seasoned politicians who have had incredible careers and have been around for a long time and have done amazing work. They, by all accounts, have been very close and have worked together. Nancy Pelosi in the House, Joe Biden in the Senate, and then eventually as vice president and president. Since the question about whether Biden should drop out of the race or not, Nancy Pelosi did a lot of work on that. Through reporting, we found out, done a lot of work on that behind the scenes and in front of the scenes, telling that it was time that if Democrats were going to win in November, that a change had to be made. That upset Joe Biden. I understand that. That seems to make perfect sense. But these are two dear friends who now have not spoken to one another for a very long time. And Ms. Pelosi has been making the rounds, giving, you know, she's been talking about the winning presidential campaign and so forth. But at no time, as she tries to get back and to talk to Biden, it's not clear when they will speak again. And for Ms. Pelosi, she admits that, it's keeping her up at night. I hope so. I pray so. I cry so. I lose sleep on it, she told David Remnick, the editor-in-chief of The New Yorker, earlier this month when pressed on whether her relationship with Mr. Biden would survive. Mr. Biden has all but disappeared from the stage, in part because of the role she played in stripping him of his power.
I think Nancy Pelosi is the real hero of this whole debacle that happened in June. And I think Joe Biden, once he gets some perspectives and sees what's happening with Kamala Harris's campaign, he's going to realize it was the right move to make. Eventually, I think they'll come they'll come around and they'll be friends. But, it just shows what a strong leader she was and how smart and savvy. I've listened to a number of these protected interviews with her. And, you know, she's just on the ball. She cares about the party. She works to protect the party. She cares about the House of Representatives. I mean, she sees the larger picture. And in this case, you know, the only thing I really would fault her for is enabling the Joe Biden presidency in the first place a year or two ago. But I think they looked at what happened with that debate and realized something had to be done. She did it artfully. I think she gave him a number of opportunities to exit more gracefully. You know, there are these conspiracy theories that, you know, she was behind it all and they wanted to put Michelle Obama in there and these crazy anti-Pelosi things. She has suffered from the misogyny that's out there in the political sphere for a long time. But, man, I just think she's the hero.
I couldn't agree more. I think I'm disappointed that Biden hasn't been magnanimous, at least in this regard. She gave him a way out, and he was wisely praised as choosing country over self, and so far, to the extent that you can tell by the attitude of the country, and the polling numbers, it was obviously the right thing to do because he had virtually no chance to be reelected, and now we see what's happened with his successor candidate. So it's Pelosi. What does she say about herself? She knows how to count, and she knew what the circumstances were and what had to be done.
Malia,
I think they were both motivated by the same thing, which is love of country, and of course. It seemed, President Biden had to be persuaded to look at things from that direction. But he eventually came around, and I think he'll come around to understand. He probably does understand what motivated her. But no doubt, for someone who's been in Washington for so long and really values and relies on the relationships, the personal relationships that he's built over many years there, it hurts to be in this situation, and especially that she had to do it publicly. It's no doubt somewhat humiliating for him. And so even though he understands it, there's that human element of regret and sadness over what it means for the personal relationship between them.
I agree with what Judy said about these interviews that she's been doing. So if the listeners have not heard them, I highly recommend them, whether it was with Ezra Klein at the New York Times podcast, or it's David Remnick, or many of the others. It's a real lesson in leadership and how our government, it's a reminder of how our government is supposed to work. She is an extraordinary leader who we know that now, but I think in history it would be more so. And I think we can't lose sight of how amazing it is that the most powerful person in the world, essentially, or one of the most powerful people in the world, agreed to give up that power. I mean, that's a very big thing that just does not happen. And it shows the character of President Biden and the fact that she helped guide him through that in a way that was much more dignified than, I think that other people are to be faulted for the way they said things in public that did not need to be done in public. And I think that she tried to dampen down some of that because she understood not only that what ultimately needed to happen, but there was some timing that in which it needed to happen, both because of the NATO summit and other things, and we know now also because of the deal that they were trying to put together to free the detainees and the hostages, and which was done just before he finalized, just before he announced. So I think that this disquiet they have between the two of them will pass, and it won't be remembered. What will be remembered was the transition that she helped him move through. They have been friends for a very long time. They will, I'm sure, continue to be friends. And together and with others, they have created an amazing legacy. And she is quick to point out in all of her discussions about his astounding legislative record. And it was, as I said a little while ago, we're celebrating the anniversary, the second anniversary of the signing of the Inflation Reduction Act. And there's the CHIPS Act. There's the there's the lowering of the prescription drugs. There's the work that he did in so many ways that affect our lives. And for the Republicans who are trying to draw a wedge between Kamala Harris and the president and say that she can't run on his record, well, I think it's just the opposite. I think that their record of accomplishment becomes the foundation of her argument for why she should be in office, and she will build on that. She doesn't need to run away from it. You know, just the fact that the U.S. has dealt with the post-pandemic economically better than any other country, right? Plus all of the other reshoring manufacturing and on and on.
Is she running for a re-election? Do you know she's going for another term this year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because she's 84, so.
But she is an 84-year-old that's really on the ball. I mean, her speech isn't as good as it used to be, and her articulation. But man, her mind, her acuity is right up there. If you listen to her engage in a really in-depth policy discussion, she's there.
And I mean, the differences. I mean, obviously, you certainly make the similarities to that of an 81-year-old president. But you do the fact that she stepped away from her leadership position. She is now a member of the House, and it's a 2-year term, and with the assumption that if things were to turn, you get out, right? So it just seems different to me.
Right. I think she is really playing the emeritus role, the mentor role, in that for Hakeem Jeffries. She is reportedly, and in talking about it in some of these discussions, about certain meetings she stopped attending because it was really for them to lead, and her being there she felt would even though invited, it's not the right role to play. But she is there as a mentor. You see how AOC, clearly, she mentored her in the beginning in ways that I think we're welcomed, and maybe not so much in the beginning, but over time, and you see her leadership skills improving. And so many other people talk about her mentorship, and you see her guiding hand in lots of legislation and other things. And I think she is really focused now on winning back the House. But just look at what the two of them, her and Biden, unleashed doesn't seem the right word, but opened up. You know, look at all the focus we've had in the last couple of weeks on this incredibly strong bench of governors and senators and others who have been out campaigning. And think about all the supports that the Harris-Walz ticket is going to give to down-ballot races. And in many states you have the abortion issue on the ballot and the guiding hand she has in that. So
you have to watch out for these people that have emeritus as part of their title. They can overstay.
Good
their,
point.
They can overstay their welcome.
You mean publisher emeritus? I
something like that. Yeah.
Yes.
But look at the guidance that you provide. Seriously, right?
Nobody listens to me.
Well, all the people listening today listen to you.
I mean, I think it's an important role, and it is something. One of the things that struck me while I was reading the article was, what about all the other people? I mean, look, Nancy Pelosi was not the only one who was going to him and saying, you seriously have to consider this. And I know that there was a friendship there and a very close relationship and bond and trust. But there were and it just seems to me, this is what Ira was saying, that, you know, she gave him so many outs and he never took those. But boy, they were offered again and again and again. And I just, you know, there were, it seems like, you know, I just don't know. Is she just bitter? Is he just bitter at her, or is he bitter about the whole thing and everybody who was a part of it?
I don't know, but I think this is, you know, of course it's not overblown, but I think in the in history, this part will be a blip. I think that she understood how to navigate and help him get to the point that
she can't sleep. She's crying in the middle of the night.
Stop.
Worry about her, Teresa.
She can't sleep because of the you know, the person who she can't name. She can't even say Trump's name. But I do think that there are some people, Senator Warner, talking about you, people who talked about this publicly in ways that I think were unseemly. That's, I guess, my word for the day, that they did not have to do it publicly. And the timing, you know, you don't say it publicly just before the NATO summit. I do think one of her most intriguing insights was when she said that when she came out, even though the letter had been sent out to the House and Senate members, she was insightful enough to, as she later said, it did not sound like Joe Biden to me. Like, this was a staff-written letter. That she, you know, when she kept saying, even though the letter had gone out saying I'm staying, she said we're still waiting for his decision, which
yes.
meant she felt that that was a staff-driven decision, not his. But in any case, I think that the bigger issues we have now are the swift voting against walls, and on a happy note, the various groups are for. Last night, the Latter-day Saints for Harris had a gathering, which I thought was fantastic. And the Mormons, you know, and all these different interest groups who are the Christians for Harris and so on and so forth. I think there are lots of other stories besides this one. I think when this story is ultimately written, it will be about how a long-term friendship helped guide him to where he would inevitably need to go and the impact it had on the country.
We shall see and we shall hope. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll wrap up this session of the roundtable panel. And thank you all for being a part of it. You can still get your letters in, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you in our remaining moments. Ira Fussfeld, Judy Patrick, Malia Dumont, and Teresa Bourgeois. We will continue after this short break in news. Talking about the former marriages of prominent news anchors. That's what we're doing.
It brings a whole new definition to the big wall.
Yeah, that's right.
Or is it the magic wall?
Yes. Good morning, all. Welcome back to the program, and we thank you very much for being with us. We have a few moments together, so let's make the most of them, shall we? We have to leave in about 10 minutes or so. We're going to hear the final part of Jim Ketterer, and I was told by Ira that I said Handler earlier, which. Bad. I think it was probably sitting in the car with the fumes. Jim Ketterer will be speaking to Robert Gassendi, and it is it's an amazing conversation, and it's been the part six, the final part of our series, will air in just a few moments, and we will get to that. In the meantime, we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Also, just a quick housekeeping matter. If you have a chance this weekend, I'm going to be having a conversation with the author Peter Heller. Peter Heller is a journalist. He is a novelist. He is a naturalist. He's an amazing writer. He has a new book out called Burn. It is a novel. And it's about two men who go out moose hunting up in Maine, and then something really bad happens. And we don't know exactly what it is, but it's sort of almost a dystopian sort of post-apocalyptic, and I won't tell you what happens, but something happens. Then they have to figure their way out of that situation. It's beautifully written. And Peter Heller is just one of our great writers. He's going to be at the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, 6 p.m. on Saturday. And I'll be interviewing him for a taping of our book show. And if you would like to join us, all you have to do is go to Northshire.com. Northshire.com. And we'd love to have you come be with us at the bookstore. Those events are so much fun. And even more fun when we have a big audience. So please, if you have a chance, join us.
I just read his book, The Last Ranger, over the weekend.
Isn't that
great? It was terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. And he'll be, that's just out in paperback. He'll be signing that book. He'll be talking about Byrne. We'll probably be talking about Last Ranger as well. Just a great, great writer. So we look forward to that. Saturday, August 17th, 6 p.m., Northshire.com. And we hope to see you there. We look forward to that. Anything else I've got going on? Okay, no, nothing else official. Let me just get to our last story for today. While I was sitting in the car yesterday, and if you wonder why, well, I told the story earlier and I'm not going to repeat it. But one of the stories that I heard, which I just thought was just the most wild thing, and I didn't realize this. Sometimes things go on in the world and you just don't know that they're going on in the world. Maybe you should. I don't know. You get busy. You forget things. I knew we sent astronauts up. Mm-hmm. I knew that they were there and I knew they were having trouble getting back. I didn't know they're still up there. My goodness. So these are the Starliner astronauts. And so the reason the story appealed to me yesterday was because
you were stuck in a car.
Yes. Well, that's right. I was a captive audience. But there was they had a press conference. NASA had this major press conference and they came out and they said the thing that you just don't usually hear at press conferences, which is, yeah, we got nothing.
Yeah, we don't know what to do.
We don't know what to do. We have. And then, like, even admitting to sort of internal infighting over how to get these astronauts back. So I thought we could take just a few moments to discuss this. Agency officials said last week that a decision was pending, they said on Wednesday, that deliberations were still taking place. A week ago, NASA officials said they would most likely need to decide by mid-August on how to safely bring home two astronauts who had traveled to the International Space Station on Boeing's troubled Starliner spacecraft. But on Wednesday, NASA said a decision remained at least a week away. Ken Bowersox, the Associate Administrator for NASA's Space Operations Mission Directorate, said, "We've got time available before we bring Starliner home, and we want to use that time wisely." However, he acknowledged that NASA could not push back a decision indefinitely. "We're reaching a point where that last week in August, we really should be making a call, if not sooner." The mission, which launched in June with the NASA astronauts, was a test flight that carried people to orbit in the Boeing spacecraft for the first time. It was designed to shake out problems before Starliner was to begin its regular missions next year to ferry NASA crews to and from the space station. The trip was scheduled to last 8 days. And a longer stay was always considered possible, but the astronauts have now been aboard the space station for more than 2 months. And uncertainty persists over when they will come home. And it just brings up all kinds of things like backup plans. How do you get them up? I was listening to this discussion in detail where they were talking about getting them new suits.
Yeah, like who's going to change their socks?
I mean, they got to get them up there. And then they said that the suits are custom fitted. And then, so they have to get the suits, but they won't be able to do the custom fitting, so they're going to have to sort of approximate, get the new suits up there, have them go in the new suits so they can go into the new, because basically the way I heard it described yesterday was it's like a Mac and an Apple type issue that they have this one system up there now, and to get them back, they would probably have to use this other system, and those systems are not compatible. Oh my God.
There's something that seems very like out of a movie, the Boeing Starliner. I mean, does that thing really exist? Yeah. It sounds like a screenplay.
You just think Matt Damon sitting up there, don't you?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's going to blast out of space. I mean, I think we rightfully have, as a society, developed a lot of confidence in the ingenuity of our scientists, because they've pulled rabbits out of hats so many times when it comes to NASA. I mean, I'll never forget how inspired I felt watching the Apollo 13 movie and how they just saved the day. But I think because space travel has become more accessible, it's still within very, very narrow bonds, but more normal, we forget how risky it is. And that every minute you spend up there as an astronaut is you're risking your life every minute. So I worry for the mental health of these astronauts who are up there beyond what they expected. I'm glad apparently they had so much extra food that they've been able to stay there this long. I mean, just the basic needs of meeting human consumption needs. It's a welcome surprise to realize that they planned for that. But things go wrong in highly, highly complex systems. And so this is not surprising in some sense.
In the press conference, they said, we believe they are in good spirits. And I thought, well, you should talk to them. see how good those spirits are.
Well, I mean, I think Malia's right. These are modern-day explorers, and there's an inherent risk that comes with being an explorer, whether you're going, the first person who discovered America or somebody up in space. I mean, I one of the things I heard was that to bring in another capsule to bring them home, or even to bring in reinforcements with supplies, there's no gate, as we would say, if it was an airport. Right now, all the gates are occupied, so they haven't figured that part out of it either. It's pretty scary. I think it's they didn't come prepared to spend months up there, and it looks like they're going to, and may still be too dangerous to leave when they have to go.
But let's face it, a good year for Boeing.
Yeah, Boeing. When you think of Boeing, you think of perfection.
All right, we're out of time. My thanks to our wonderful group this morning. I appreciate you all being here. Thank you both Ira and Judy are off to a taping of the media project, so they'll be busy. Malia and Teresa are free to go. My thanks to all of you. Be well. We'll be back right after this.